Before I get started with the actual episode, this was recorded a few days before release day. So a couple of things. We know a little bit more about Tatiana Jefferson's execution, basically her death, at the hands of the former police officer. What we know is that there was a welfare check. The person, her elderly black neighbor, called 311, the equivalent of what their 311 is. It's 311 here, the non-emergency number in Baltimore. But anyway, she called the equivalent, or he called the equivalent, her neighbor, of 311, the non-emergency number there. And a police officer showed up. And you know, the story at this point, all of the lights were on in our house, and I believe her front door was open. He opened with, he called out with his gun drawn, and within 4 to 5 seconds after he called out to her, he shot. Now, what we know is that it's possible that she also had some sort of weapon, because there was a man outside her door. There was a man outside and she didn't know what the heck was going on. So I think a lot more is going to come out of that case. But the point is, she was gunned down. Tatiana was gunned down in her own home within 4 to 5 seconds because this guy, a former police officer, responded to a non-emergency call. Non-emergency call with violence, ready to go. And didn't, it's, I mean, we're still learning, but the point is, this was wild and it shouldn't have happened. And, you know, listening to a lot of different podcasters, Tea with Queen and Jay and other folks, it's true. Like, we have problems with police in the United States. The system of policing in the United States is broken. And while I don't agree that training won't solve it, I'm not convinced that training won't solve it. Good training. I don't know. I'm still on the fence. I don't know that abolition. I'm not an abolitionist, police abolitionist, but I just know that something has to give. And I think a person who chooses to call the police, even a non-emergency number, in a case of an emergency for a welfare check, in place of themselves, is doing it because of safety. And I'm not talking about those folks who call because they start something and they want the police to finish it. I'm talking about folks who think that there might be danger involved, but they're gonna call somebody who's being paid to go and investigate these things, hoping that they respond with the correct amount of energy, right? And unfortunately, this former police officer did not. And so, you know, her neighbor did the right thing, because the alternative would have been him going over to this woman's house and who knows what would have happened. Right? He's not a police officer. You stay warm in your comfortable home, call the people whose job it is to come out there and investigate certain things, but investigate in the appropriate way. But again, so on and so forth. Anyway, but so that I wanted to change that. And I'm also recording this on the morning of the passing of Congressman Elijah Cummings. What you need to know about his significance in my life is that when I moved to Baltimore, I can't tell you how many times I was in a room with Elijah Cummings since I've been here. He was accessible. He was a congressperson that was accessible. And you don't always get that in your political leaders. But he was. I have been fortunate. I tell you, one of the reasons why I love Baltimore so much is that because they call Baltimore Smaltimore. And there's a reason for it. There is a certain attachment that you get here. There are a lot of international companies and a lot of big wigs, movers and shakers who come out of Baltimore. But there's something about how easy it is to access folks here in the city. I can't even describe it to you. I have been over the last, 12 years at this point that I've lived in Baltimore, or coming up on 12 years. I saw Elijah Cummings in person and had an opportunity to shake his hand and speak with him at least 4 or 5. That was my congressperson. And a husband and a friend and so many things to so many different people. And fun fact, my chapter, we were actually going to reach out to him to speak at our upcoming gala, our chapter anniversary and scholarship gala in February, but that's done now. Yeah, so he will be missed. Yep, he'll be missed. All right, here's the show. Thank you.
I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This week, as we are creeping closer and closer to Halloween, I want to talk about a film that scared the pants off me when I was a child. And the movie I want to talk about is Tales from the Hood. It's old at this point, but it's like a cult classic, Tales from the Hood. Okay, so I said maybe a couple of months ago, maybe a month or two ago, that I hadn't watched one of the latest series or seasons of American Horror Story, Apocalypse, because Kid Fury from The Read said during one of their episodes that the show was scary and yeah, it was full of the way he described why it was scary for him and why he needed to watch kitten videos and pray and listen to gospel after the fact was because it had some demonic themes in it and definitely spiritual warfare and all of that. But I had no idea watching the season exactly what it entailed. And so I ended up, I don't even know what made me watch it other than I had been thinking about, you know, creepy stories and folklore and black spirituality and all of that stuff. And while American Horror Story, that season, I don't even know what season it is, but it's Apocalypse. But season four or five, I can't call it. Anyway, not that series had anything to do with black spirituality, but I was just thinking, you know, as I did last year, just thinking about black spirituality and the scary stories that, or the stories that are scary to black folk, and just go with me for a second. Things can be scary to all people groups, all cultures, right? But like, there are certain things that resonate in the black community as more scary than that might resonate as just generally scary in others. Do you know what I mean? Other communities. And for a whole different set of reasons, like I don't even have to tell you the social climate of today and the social climate for black people in the United States for centuries. Well, not centuries, but probably century. Yes, it's changed. It has changed and it is always different. Even as our circumstances have improved, there's still an element of danger being black in the United States. So anyway, and I'm not even exaggerating about that for so many different reasons. There was a woman whose life was taken the other day by, Dallas Fort Worth police in her own home. I don't know the circumstances of that, but it's just, anyway, it doesn't seem like taking a life is the last resort in many of these police interactions. That goes without saying. We've been saying that. Black folks have been saying that for decades, but nevertheless, I digress. But anyway, you can appreciate how, even if you're not from the United States, even if you're not Black American, you can appreciate how there are certain things that are scarier to Black folks than might be for other culture groups, right? So anyway, but going back to American Horror Story Apocalypse, I ended up watching it and it was scary, but not as scary as I thought it was going to be. It ended up being more campy than anything. And this is a person who I genuinely do not like watching scary movies that are more psychological or spiritually based because that messes with me. It messes with me because a lot of these spiritual concepts aren't games to me. They are something that has an element of truth to it, and I could go on, but if you're a spiritual person, for the most part, there are certain things that you don't play with, or the certain things that you have a certain respect for. And so when it comes to spirituality and it comes to horror, I don't tend to mix those things, or at the very least, I don't watch those things because they are scary to me. Plus, I have an active imagination, so just layers on top of layers of reasons why I am a punk when it comes to watching scary films. So anyway, but I ended up watching the entire season and I slept fine. There were a couple of times where I watched it to sleep. because it was interesting. And I, you know, the binging a show, you know, you want to just keep watching. But anyway, it was entertaining to me. The story was good. There were irksome elements to it, of course, but for the most part, it was pretty campy, but still good and intriguing to me. And the way it ended was just like, okay, it's American Horror Story. What are you going to do? Yeah, I encourage you to watch it because it is interesting. It's interesting. And I do appreciate how they recycle actors. I always love how the actors' storylines end, but I do love the fact that they hold on to actors, but then put them in different and new situations. I think that's cool. Anyway, but so I ended up watching that, and it wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be, but it got me to thinking about something that Kid Fury had said maybe around the time, actually exactly when the time Us came out, talking about he's ushering in a new wave of black films, black horror films, but he's adding an element of, you know, with Us and then Get Out. You know, he started with Get Out and then Us. He went on to do Us, and now we're just waiting on bated breath to see what else he's coming out with. And the idea that both of those stories had an element of scariness that was maybe different for other people. With Get Out, it was literally using black bodies as a vessel for you to, you know, put on blackness. You're literally putting on blackness. That was, spoiler alert, that is the concept for Get Out. If you have the coins, if you have the moral bankruptcy, you can think of black people as objects that you can possess, and not only possess, but you can embody and have a full life in their own body, living in a way that maybe you never dreamed of living before. And so you inhabit those bodies, right? So that's essentially, you know, And that movie has been studied down at this point, and I'm sure it's been somebody's dissertation subject. Anyhow, so that was Get Out. And then Us, not necessarily putting on black bodies, but from a black family's perspective, just talking about how there's this huge social experiment that you really need to be paying attention, not social experiment, governmental experiment that you really need to be, should have been paying attention to, because the United States has been taking pieces of you. And not only did they take pieces of you, they took pieces of you at birth and had since given birth to a clone of you. For some sort of purpose, unknown purpose. And then when they abandoned it, they literally abandoned it unto its own devices and moved on to the next great, latest and greatest, and left this huge humanitarian crisis on our hands. I mean, it didn't go into that detail, certainly, but, you know, as I looked at it, that's kind of some of the takeaways that I got to. But I guess my point with all of that is these concepts are something that maybe somebody's come close, but they've never quite gotten there before. And I think that can only come from a mind, or let me back up before I say something that's a little weird. It takes different perspectives, different life perspectives, and somebody looking through life with a particular lens to come up with concepts and stories that might be new and fresh, right? Give folks a chance, and they might tell you something you've never heard before. And, I have forgotten the director's name. Oh my goodness, Jordan Peele. And so in these two movies, Jordan Peele has done something, has said something that we haven't heard said before. Shown us something that we haven't seen before. And again, that's why so many folks are waiting on bated breath to see what's about to happen. And it's going to be something psychological, and it's going to be something, a play on some of the things that we complain about on Twitter and social media and in the news media. And it's going to be something, I hope that he continues this, but it's going to be something that's either from a black person's perspective, or it's definitely going to be involving black culture in some way. And I appreciate that immensely, because again, you know, most TV and And I'm saying again, as if I started this conversation just now in this episode, but what I mean is, I think I've been saying on this show, on this podcast, since the very beginning, is that what we all know is true, that a lot of TV, especially American TV, is focused on catering to a white audience. And what we're supposed to do as people of color, specifically, well, just black people, but people of color at large, is to imagine ourselves in that position, imagine ourselves on that show, but not actually see ourselves on that show. Find ways to identify with those characters, even though we don't see those ourselves on that screen. And so it has traditionally been too high of a hill to climb to get representation, to get someone that looks like me in lead roles, not supporting roles or not bit parts. So traditionally it has been how it is. And so we're getting change now. Pose helps. That's a brand new story. Not been told and not been given the credit that it has always deserved, right? So that's great. Even just trans actresses and actors. I don't know if there are any trans actors that have been given. I can't think of any trans actors that have been given a shot in film, but definitely. I'm even gendering it. So trans women have been given a platform to be shown on screen. And I don't know maybe I'm just too ignorant to know. I don't know if trans men have been given a platform apart from Chaz Bono. Like, that's the only one I know that has spent time in movies and films and things like that, shows. But I know that there are that exist, and I know that there are some that are getting some sort of play. I hope there are even some that I haven't heard of that are getting play regardless, right? So representation is great. You know, we've got Crazy Rich Asians, a whole cast that was predominantly Asian descent, or the part of the diaspora, I'll say that. Wonderful. You know, even Undone, which is focusing lately, you got Jane the Virgin that's focusing on Latinx family. You've got, there's so many things there are more things that are on TV, however you get it, through Netflix, Hulu, big screen, the network TV. There's more representation happening. I applaud that, but there still needs to be a lot more, because there are a whole lot more different stories to tell. That's why I loved Undone so much, because I'd never seen mental illness and spirituality talked about in that way before. I hadn't. I think the only thing that came a little close was Eve's Bayou, although the time period that it came in, it was still really, when Eve's Bayou was produced, it was still really kind of taboo to talk about mental illness, because that was a 90s flick, right? And so anyway, I feel very much that there was mental illness, and obviously there was sexual trauma, there was trauma, and PTSD and all of that stuff was in it, but you weren't really talking about it, right? Because there was this other thing that was happening throughout the film, and there was spirituality in there too, but like Undone is the closest I've seen to a film these days that is incorporating religious traditions, multiple religious traditions, really, if you're thinking about it, as well as cultural practices, which I loved. So I want to see, but you get what I'm saying? You'll only get those voices if you're reaching out to people who don't look like what we've traditionally, and why we, I'm saying the American public and those folks that can make decisions. You're looking beyond yourself. You're looking beyond people who look like you to hear different stories. And so that's great. But anyway, but what we know is there have been stories told for decades from different perspectives. Maybe they've been, but they sometimes they've been put in the camp category. Sometimes they're just indie films and they never really get play on the big screen because other things are taking precedence, you know? And for me, it's like when, you know, when I was growing up, I thought everybody had seen these, but you know, seeing certain films, especially certain black films. But what I didn't realize were, number one, I didn't realize it was a black film. I just thought it was black people in it. But that was my perspective. And then two, I didn't realize that, you know, certain films are marketed to specific, as if they would only appeal to certain demographics, right? So we tend to call a thing a black film because it's for the most part being marketed to black people. And I don't believe Us was a black film. I think it was a film starring a black family, but it wasn't a black film. And I'm saying that and not trying to be funny about it, but what I'm bringing it up because I'm saying I want to get to a point where we can tell black stories and those black stories can be heard by everyone because they're not just for black people. They're not just to be told to black people. They might be focusing on black people, but they're not just for black people. Because that's how we get these little subgenres where, and then that's how we get these ceilings that people can never climb over. And I know somebody's going to argue me down about that, but like I maintain, I'm not saying that I just want there to be movies. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I want Undone to be seen by everybody. Just, and if you don't identify as Latinx, if you don't identify as mestizo, or if you don't identify as indigenous at all, you can still find joy in that movie. You can still be entertained by that movie. You can still find, be inspired by that movie. You don't have to be a part of that culture to be inspired by that movie. But I think our Hollywood system is, and our film system is set up where we only, if it's a predominantly brown cast or if it's a predominantly people of color cast, we only market it. We target our marketing to that group that they're representing. And that's dumb. And that's late. And we're over it. We ought to be over it. But nevertheless, a lot of films that I grew up watching, Love and Basketball, even though I really didn't like the movie, but Love and Basketball, Best Man, The Wood, Waiting to Exhale, Boys in the Hood, all of those were starring black people and marketed to black people as a black film, right? And, you know, growing up, I thought everybody watched these films, but then, you know, I go to college and I realized, no, just black people and people who were in and around black folk watch those films. That it wasn't necessarily a widely watched thing. And this is me. So how can I put this? So, you know, if you've listened to any of these episodes, you know, I grew up in a predominantly white community, but what you also need to understand is I didn't go spend a lot of time with other people. I didn't spend time over people's houses. I had one best friend whose house I spent the night over, and they had all sorts of movies. Did they have The Best Man? Did they have a lot of black films? No, but I didn't necessarily think, I thought that was them. You know what I mean? I didn't necessarily think that it wasn't everybody, because when I would go to school, again, I was the token black girl. So everybody was up on the latest, you know, the latest rap, the latest styles and stuff. Always going to Kansas City for the latest Tim's. He was literally walking around in this little country old town, walking around with Tim's. Do you know what I mean? So to me, I was like, okay, so everybody consumes this, right? Everybody loves blackness, right? What I was really observing when I was younger, but I didn't have the language for, was that I was seeing people consume black culture with not necessarily respect for black people. But that was a whole nother conversation. That is a whole nother conversation. But anyway, so long story short, I thought a lot of people watched a lot of these films, right? Come to find out, nope, they were mostly marketed to black people and mostly black people watched them. So anyway, one of those films that I thought everybody had watched, but when I went to college, it was like a cult classic among black people, and we would pull it out and talk about it, was Tales from the Hood. And Tales from the Hood is a trip because on the face of it, you think it's like Tales from the Crypt, you know? And it kind of is, in that it is short stories, vignettes of sorts, all horror-based, all scary, but they're different. And there's, I can't remember if Tales from the Crypt all had a through line, like something connecting all of them. But the thing that sets Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Hood apart, was that there is absolutely one thing that's connecting all of the stories in this movie together. And it is told in a pretty interesting way. And, you know, I was younger when it came out, so I didn't really have the I wasn't really interested in any of the backstory to it or who was producing it or what have you, or even the stars that were in it. I just knew that there was that creepy guy. There was a creepy guy who was playing a funeral director, and I always knew that he was scary, and I just loved his voice because he was like a Vincent Price for me. He was like a black Vincent Price in that he just had this presence that was super scary. And you know who I'm talking about, because it's Clarence Williams III. That man is scary. He can have a scary affect. And I just thought he was scary. And then I saw David Alan Greer in it, and I was like, oh, but David Alan Greer, he's on In Living Color. He's supposed to be funny. But he wasn't funny in this film. And so that was interesting to me. Paula J. Parker, I didn't really know her like that as an actress. Like, I'd seen her in a few things, but did I think she was funny? No, I just thought she was just like a round the way girl. She always played around the way girl. And then there was Joe Torre, who I knew as a comedian because I had watched Comic View. So I had seen him on Comic View or some sort of comedy something on BET. So I thought he was a comic, you know, and then I'm seeing him in the film and he's not very funny. And then I see a guy called Corbin Burnson. Now, Corbin Burnson, I knew he was a serious actor, and I knew he wasn't funny. It's just, I guess I was intrigued that he was in there because I'd seen him in bigger films, quote unquote bigger films, and I was like, well, what are you doing in this little thing? But anyway, so there were a few folks that I recognized, and certainly there's a full cast of people who are here, who are in this show that make it great, this movie that makes it great. But one of the things I didn't realize was that Spike Lee produced it. It was executive produced by, co-produced by Spike Lee and some other dude who you can look up yourself. Anyway, and I guess I can appreciate why that had an element of polish to it, because the movie to me is polished. It's polished in a way that I wouldn't expect a quote unquote hood film to be polished, or a film of this type, this genre, because it's kind of, for all intents and purposes, a little bit campy, but it's also preachy too. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me looking at the details of it now that it was co-executive produced by Spike Lee. So in the next segment, I'm going to just talk about the particulars of Tales from the Hood, and then I'm going to go into the little vignettes about the show. All right, so I told you who a few folks that I recognize that were in it, but I'll go through it again. So Clarence William III, he plays like the funeral director, right? Who's narrating all of these vignettes. Then we got Joe Torre, who's one of one of the young thugs that comes in. And I'll tell the story in a second. But anyway, so Joe Torre plays a young thug. Corbin Burnson, who I had only seen from like serious dramas, not serious dramas, you get what I'm saying, mainstream dramas. But anyway, he plays in one of the vignettes as a person who's running for election or re-election or something like that. Then you've got David Alan Greer, who plays a step-parent in one of the vignettes, who's not so nice. And then you have Paula J. Parker, who is a parent in one of the vignettes, who is with David Alan Greer. Then you've got, like, some of these people's names I don't know, so I'm not even going to bother with it. I think Anthony Griffith, let me click on this. Who the heck is Anthony Griffith? Anthony Griffith. I don't know who that is. Anyway, he's one of them people. Ooh. Anyway, he plays the teacher in one of the vignettes with Paula J. Parker and David Alan Greer. Anyway, you could look it up for yourself. But anyway, these are the folks that I remember. Paula J. Parker, Joe Torre, Corbin Burnson, and Clarence William III, David Alan Greer. Okay, so some of the particulars. Okay, so I told you that it was produced by Spike Lee's company, 40 Acres and a Mule. It was distributed by Savoy Pictures, which I don't even know if that thing is around anymore. No, it's defunct. It was in operation from 92 to 97. So it's done now. So it was distributed by the now defunct Savoy Pictures. It was released May 24th, 1994. The running time is 98 minutes. And it was budgeted for $6 million. They budgeted $6 million, but the box office brought in $11.8 million. So they made their money back, and then they made a little coins on the back end. And what I will say is, so the film was released in 95, right? The summer of 95, early summer of 95, right? What you need to know about 95 is, the film and a lot of how the stories are colored are a reflection of the time period of what was going on in the United States in 1995. So think about it this way. So the film was released on May 4th, 1995, but it was probably filmed in 94, right? Sometime in 94, maybe 6-7 months over, 94. The screenplay was written finished probably in early 94 or whatever, but who knows? It was probably done in 93, 92. You know what I mean? So what we're really saying is early 90s written film that was released yet still in the early 90s. And it is a reflection of the time. So what was happening 92, 93, 94, right? When this thing was being written and when it was being filmed. You had the riots in LA that were a direct result, I believe, and one of y'all is going, you can check me on this if you want. But it was either in direct reaction to the video release of Rodney King being brutalized by those police officers, the LAPD officers, or the result of the trial. I think the riot actually began because of the video. I think it was in reaction to the video being widespread and no charges being filed against these people. It could be. Although I could also see there being rioting because there was a no conviction. No criminal charges brought up against all of those police officers that were clearly caught stomping this man, right? I think beyond what happened there, I think, the LAPD during that time was embroiled with controversy because they had a ton of police brutality cases against them. So you've got police brutality, especially in large metropolitan police departments, the LAPD being one of the most notorious at the time. So you have that, and this was directly impacting Black people, right? And then you had, we're still coming out of the crack epidemic, and you had the three strikes rule. I think the three strikes rule had come in, so they were basically cracking down on a bunch of people who were drug dealers and sending them up. Third strike, third time they were arrested, a third time they were convicted of that particular crime, they were going up for years, right? Or for life, right? So there were mass incarceration, criminalization of being an addict was happening in that time. And that was disproportionately impacting the Black community, Black and brown people, but the Black community for sure, right? Then you also had, just generally speaking, Black people being aware that, we did a lot in the 60s. We did a lot even in the 70s to try to bring attention to what's going on in the Black community and, how there need to be more resources and more opportunities for Black folks to excel, right? And so here we are in the 90s, and it's like, so we've been saying this for a minute, and yet here we are with the same old, same old. I'm tired of y'all trying to pander to me and not doing anything. So you have this background, right? You have this background. Oh, and by the way, in the middle of this, so you have the crack epidemic, that's where we have a hangover from that. So it exploded in the 80s, right? But we're still feeling the remnants of it in the early 90s, right? It hasn't gone anywhere. But what we are waking up to is the fact that you can't just put this on Black people and Black and poor people and expect us to take the brunt of the fact that we're selling these drugs and consuming these drugs. But how do these drugs get in our communities? We don't have boats. What it was said, and that I can't even quote the film, but there's a film that everybody has seen, where Wesley Snipes is a bad guy, and he is, I can't call the name of it, but he's a bad guy, and he has this line in the film where he's being brought up, he's in a courtroom, and he's saying, you know, we don't have. And he's a drug dealer, right? And he's being brought up on drug charges, and he's flipping and he's turning state's evidence, right? In the middle of his testimony. And he's saying, you know, we don't own the boats that get the smuggle the cocaine from Colombia over here. We don't own the single engine planes. You know, we are but a player in this big scheme, this big old conspiracy to flood the black community with drugs. I am but one person. You think you got the big person? There's somebody bigger than me who got the drugs here in the first place, right? And there's a lot of truth to that, even though he was a punk and a coward in that film, and he got what he deserved in that film. And some of y'all know what I'm talking about, but I cannot remember the name of the film that I'm talking about. But okay, so more context about that particular film before I come back to the context of what Tales from the Hood was written in. The establishment that Wesley Snipes and his crew took over this building, and they called it the Carter. I don't know. Come on. I know y'all know this. And so anyway, yeah, so it's right on the tip of my tongue, but I can't call it. But anyway, so yeah, Wesley Snipes is this big time gun dealer, and I keep wanting to say Harlem Nights, but it's not Harlem Nights, even though there was drugs in Harlem Nights. Can't call the name of it. But anyway, he took over this building and he called it the Carter, and it was like, he ran that thing like a business. It was awesome, but terrible at the same time. Anyway, so he had said that epic line, and it made a lot of sense, even though he was a fool, and even though you can't deny the fact that a lot of the folks that were going to jail, they were going to jail for selling drugs. Now, you could get into an argument, well, why were they selling drugs? Because they don't have the resources, and that's true too. So I don't want to have that conversation, but the point is, the backdrop of this film is, you know, the black community is waking up to the fact that we're disproportionately being locked up for these crimes. And are locked up for a long time for these crimes, but you got these white collar criminals who often are white, who are getting slaps on the wrist for doing dastardly devious things, right? So anyway, and then you've got police brutality, so excessive force, and yeah, just black folk had a bad way to go. And so you also have a resurgence of gangs. And when people think of the early 90s, they think of gangs in L.A. But what you don't know is that what we don't often remember is that gangs were everywhere. Gang culture everywhere. Gang culture permeated urban culture across the United States, across America, right? North America, specifically United States, though. And anyway, so gang culture was prevalent, and there was, you know, high crime, lots of black youth dying, specifically black males. There was this Surgeon General's warning, or maybe not a warning, but there was a report that came out that there was the life expectancy of a black male between the age of a young black male was not beyond 25, especially if they lived in an urban environment. So this is the backdrop of this film, right? And so I say all that to say, there's a whole lot of respectability politics that are laced throughout these vignettes. So there's a lot of meaning in these vignettes, and a lot of meaningful messages for the black community, but a lot of those messages are laced with, if you just dress this way, if you just behave this way, good things will come to you. You will avoid a lot of those terrible things that befall us, those terrible outcomes that befall black folks. If you just but act differently, you will receive different results. And what we know is, you could be a lawyer in a three-piece suit in the most expensive car ever, and you could still be pulled over. And if there's a trigger-happy cop that has pulled you over with a short fuse, you going. You getting locked up for whatever reason. You're getting, you may even get shot, you know? And it's, we know it's not all the time, but it happens enough. Do you know what I mean? I mentioned the woman who was shot and killed in her own home, right? Dallas-Fort Worth. Shot and killed in her own home. Now, again, I don't know what the circumstance of that was, but again, it's shooting to death
seems to be what folks are being trained to do. And I would think that that would be a last resort, but it seems like the first one. Anyway, so you've got this backdrop. But back in the day, we really did think as a Black culture, there was a whole huge swath of us that thought if you behaved a certain way, if you dressed a certain way, if you were humble enough, you would not succumb to these tragic circumstances. And so a lot of the themes in the short film and the short stories, the vignettes, are respectability. They're laced with respectability politics. So anyway, so let me start with the first one. So the first vignette is called Rogue Cop Revelation. And when I'm going through these vignettes, I'm not going to give you every single detail. I would rather you just watch the thing. But what I will give you is the juicy parts, the parts that give you context to the story. So the first one, like I said, is the Rogue. It's called Rogue Cop Revelation. And it's essentially... It essentially involves four people. So three of them are cops. One of them is a Black cop. The other three cops are white, right? So four cops, one Black. Five people. So four of them are cops. Three of them are white. One is Black. And then you have a Black civil rights activist that is also a council person in this particular city, this particular fictitious city. And this Black cop gets pulled over one night by two white officers. And as happens sometimes in real life, another squad car comes up after this first car has already pulled them over. And the second squad car is pulled up and it's the Black cop and the white cop, right? And what has happened before they pulled up is that the councilman has been beaten up pretty badly, right? And, you know, the white officer that's partnered with the Black officer, the white guy gets out and he joins in on the fun. And they want, I don't know that he joins in on the fun, but they want the Black cop to be in it on it too. And the Black cop is like, no, this is wrong. Y'all really ought to take him to the doctor. Y'all, or not the doctor, but the emergency room. This is wrong. Let's quit while we're ahead. You got your revenge out of him. And the fun fact is, not fun fact, but the backstory is that this civil rights activist has been a pain in the police officer's side because he's been, you know, speaking truth to power, putting a flashlight on their on all of the police corruption in that particular department, right? So again, kind of mirroring the issues that were going on and trying to be exposed in the LAPD, right? Anyway, fun fact, hopefully it's the last sidebar, but you know Condoleezza Rice? Condoleezza Rice has a sister who is an attorney. And throughout the 90s, I was listening to a podcast maybe 3 or 4 years ago where she said there was one point where I woke up every day wondering how I could sue the LAPD. I just thought that was hilarious. But the reason why she said it is because I know they're dirty. They're proven dirty. They keep treating Black folks foul. They keep abusing them. So there was a point where, and I know she was exaggerating, but she was like, there was a point where I woke up every day just trying to look for a reason to sue the LAPD until they changed their ways. And I was just like, girl, how y'all grow up in the same household? But anyway, but I digress. So anyway, so these police officers were targeting this council person and they had abused them because he had been telling on police officers, telling on cops basically, and trying to expose them for expose corruption within the city's department. And so they were going to get their get back on all the times that this, councilman had told on their peers. And so they beat him up. And then again, so the Black cop comes and his partner joins in and all of that. But the Black cop is like, no, take him to the police. And at this point, the Black cop is a rookie. He's like young, right? And his partner is seasoned. So it's basically like, oh, this is the way, you know, we're blue. We're not white or Black. We're blue. Something to that effect, you know, keep the code. And so they convince the other three white officers, convince the Black officer that they are going to take the councilman to the hospital. Now, think about that for a second. These police officers, before the time of cameras, have beaten the brakes off of this Black political figure, right?
Do you really think that they're going to take them to the hospital? No. And of course, in the vignette, they don't take him to the hospital. In fact, they take him to a doc. And not only do they take him to a doc, but they load him up with heroin. They shoot him up with heroin while he's dazed still from the beating that he took. And they push him off. They push him off the dock in his car with heroin in his system and still with the syringe in his arm. And I think a bottle of something, open bottle of something in the car. Anyway, so naturally his body is found. He's dead. His body is found. And, you know, he goes down in disgrace posthumously. He's labeled a crook. He's labeled a sellout and all of that stuff. And surprise, surprise, the black cop, riddled with guilt, becomes a drunk. He becomes a drunk and he dreams a lot about, well, not dreams. He has a lot of nightmares about this council person. So this council person comes to him in his dreams and he's basically haunting him to do right, turn the situation right, get justice for me, help me get justice. And he actually manifests and does that, you know, reaches out to him and says, you got to give me justice or something to that effect. So anyway, long story short, there's a plan is hatched. The black cop, who is no longer a cop, he's actually a former cop at this point, he hatches a plan to, on the anniversary of the councilman's death, or murder, to bring the white officers who were a part of it back together. Now again, this guy's he's an addict at this point. He's not even in recovery. He's an alcoholic. And so he looks like one. His skin is terrible. He looks greasy. He looks dirty. He looks like he's been in the bottle. He looks like he's been living in the bottom of a bottle. Do you know what I mean? Figuratively. And so, blah, 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 blah. So long story short, it comes back that, you know, they come to the police officers on the anniversary. The three white cops come back and like, yeah, we're going to reminisce with you. The former cop, somehow or another, they end up at his gravesite, at the councilman's gravesite. And one of the officers just disgustingly relieves himself on the gravesite, and then some stuff happens from there. Anyway, it's I'm not going to tell you all of it, but just know that it's like a revenge story, right? Yeah, it's like a revenge story, and something happens actually to the black cop too. But I won't tell you what happens. Anyway, so that's the rogue cop revelation. Before I started to tell you that, what you need to know is, Joe Torre, who plays one of the gangbangers. And the whole premise of this thing is that Clarence William III is walking around Joe Torre and this other, thug who, long story short, you remember Players Club? If you've watched Players Club, Junior, who is that light-skinned girl, the light-skinned one with the blonde hair. So not Diamond, but Diamond's nemesis, whose name I cannot call right now. But anyway, she has blonde hair. And anyway, her brother, the guy that plays Junior, her brother, he is another thug in this film alongside of Joe Torre, right? So Joe Torre and this guy who played Junior in Players Club is being escorted around the mortuary by Clarence William III, right? Funeral director, right? And again, the premise is they've both come to meet Clarence William III because he's got drugs. That he needs to give them for their boss or whatever. But they don't actually say it's drugs. They actually, what do they call it? They don't call it drugs. They call it something else, some other term. But they never say drugs, but you know that it's drugs, right? Anyway, or at least the implication is that they're coming to pick up drugs. So anyway, while they're going through the mortuary, the funeral home, to pick up the package, to pick up the drugs, the Clarence William III, as the funeral director, is walking by certain objects in the funeral home, and they're eliciting certain stories. Either Joe Torre or the other guy is picking up a piece, an object, or Clarence William III walks by something, and there's a question of what's this, what's that? Oh, that looks funny, and then launches into the story. So I don't remember what launched the story about the rogue cop revelation that launched rogue cop revelation. I just know that each time there is an object that launches the funeral director into telling the story. So the first one was, like I said, it's a rogue cop revelation. The second one is entitled Boys Don't Get Bruised. Now, this is where Paula J. Parker is in it, and David Alan Greer is in it too. And then I think it's Anthony Griffith. Is light-skinned guy with locks at the time. Anyway, yeah, so basically, and this little boy, whose name I can't call right now. But anyway, so long story short, this little boy, he's got this black teacher, this black male teacher, and he has a really great relationship with him, but the black male teacher notices that this little kid is drawing things. And I think the little kid is new too. He's new to the neighborhood, right? So he's drawing things and he's saying that he's having trouble sleeping and he's got trouble at home. And then the little kid basically tells his teacher that, you know, I have this monster that haunts me at night. And long story short, he begins to see bruises on the little boy. And the little boy says, oh, it's the monster. And so the teacher, you know, calls his mother, which is Paula J. Parker, and you know, is saying, oh, I'm very concerned. And then there's a point where it's like there's like a love connection between the teacher and his mom, and Paula J. Parker. It's like really weird because, I mean, you think about the reason why he's calling the mom in the office. It's because he believes that the kid is being abused. He thinks the kid is being physically abused, like beaten. Right. And so that there's this weird something that happens and come to, you know, so he's like, you know, what's going on? And she's like, oh, he's just got an active imagination. He's like, well, what about these bruises, though? And he's like, this is my business or something like that. You know how it goes, especially in the 90s, folks attitude toward child abuse. You really didn't talk about it. It was always an excuse to say it was something else. It's not what you think. Blah, blah, blue. So anyway, you know, but so, you know, she kind of leaves that meeting abruptly and she's like, you know, you mind your business. My child is my child. My child is fine. We're going to work on this demon. We're going to work on it. Right. Because I didn't told him to stop making up fantasies and stories. Long story short, the teacher is not convinced that these are just stories. This monster is not made up. He literally thinks the monster is another name, that the kid is too scared to name the person that is abusing him. So and that he doesn't think his mom is abusing him. But that he thinks someone in the household is abusing him. And so the teacher thinks that, oh, there's not actually a monster, but the person that you're calling the monster is the person that's abusing you, right? So, so long story short, he basically, somehow or another, he tells the kid, you know, the kid gets in his head, and I can't remember if it's the teacher that tells him, somehow or another, the kid gets it in his head that if you take this piece of paper and you crumble it up, that it'll kill your demon. Basically, whatever you do to that piece of paper, you'll feel that for the demon, for this monster that you're scared of, that's harming you, right? And so, long story short, we come to find out that the person that's actually harming him is David Alan Greer, which is Paula J. Parker's either husband, maybe not husband, but like boyfriend. Definitely not, I don't think it's this little boy's father, but definitely like a step or something like that. And anyway, the monster that is coming to mess with this little boy and abuse this little boy is actually David Alan Greer. And so, yeah, so there's a point where the climax of the story where the teacher and Paula J. Parker, the teacher comes to the house, and Paula J. Parker and David Alan Greer are there, and the little boy is there, and this boy has this picture. And he does something with the picture, and some stuff happens. And it's interesting, and you should watch it. But it was good, even though it was a little cringy, because again, there was a little bit of a love connection, or it was like the film wanted you to see that there was a little love connection between the teacher and Paula J. Parker. But it was like weird, because why would you want to inject yourself romantically in a situation where you know clearly there's abuse happening? Like, it's kind of weird, but it's still interesting, and you should definitely watch it. And I think what prompted that story was that one of the thugs saw the picture of the monster that this little boy drew. And so they're like, what in the world is this little picture? And then Clarence William III launches into the story about the boys don't get bruised. And then the next vignette is KKK comeuppance. And what prompts this story is that one of the thugs, and I think it's the dude that played Junior on the Players Club, he sees a little doll, like a little puppet doll is sitting on like a mantle. You know how some people have an elf on the shelf? It kind of it's like an elf on the shelf, but it's a little puppet doll that looks like he's black, and he's dressed in like old timey raggedy clothes, right? And so one of the thugs walks back behind us, say, oh, this little doll's ugly, or makes some sort of disparaging remark about the doll, right? And then Clarence William III launches into talks about that, a story behind that doll. And actually, this was one of the most interesting stories to me. And this involved Corbin Burnson and the guy who I always thought was fine growing up. I still think he is fine. I'm gonna give you part of his CV. So in the movie Malcolm X, he played the light-skinned guy that was half white when Malcolm X was before Malcolm X was Malcolm X, when he was still Malcolm Little and he was robbing them houses and he had that white girlfriend. There was this, this black guy that was supposed to be biracial. And, you know, he had that tense scene with Detroit Red, Malcolm. No, he was Malcolm Little when he was little. He was Detroit Red when he was grown. And he was Malcolm X when he was in the Nation. Anyway, so, you know, Denzel as Detroit Red at this point. And he's has this tense confrontation with that light-skinned dude. That's the same light-skinned dude that is in this vignette with Corbin Burnson. Fun fact, the same light-skinned dude that I'm talking about, whose name I cannot remember, he played Huey P. Newton in a one-man show that came on HBO. It was a one-man play, and it was really, really good. And I think he actually had another one-man play on HBO, but it was something else. I forgot what other historical, black historical figure that he was playing, but he's really, really good. He's been in a lot of things. He's been in a lot of black film. Ooh, he played the guy that played Bugging Out, but the guy that was, he had developmental disabilities, the guy that always had the tracts and that wanted people to sign the tracts or whatever, or he was handing out religious tracts and he wanted money in exchange for whatever he was giving you, that guy in Do the Right Thing. I'm sorry, I didn't even name the film. Do the Right Thing. I cannot remember the name of the actor, but the actor that played that guy, right? What else? He played in a lot of stuff, but you should get it at this point, who I'm talking about. So this one stars Corbin Burnson and that light-skinned black guy that I was just telling you about. Anyway, he is an awesome actor, this light-skinned black guy. I just can't remember his name. Anyway, so the light-skinned black guy that's awesome plays Corbin Burnson's basically his aide, his press secretary or something like that. He's always around him. Anyway, and so Corbin Burnson, I can't even think of a film that you might have known him in. Just Google him. But it's like Corbin, C-O-R-B
E-N or something like that. Cora, I-N, whatever. Anyway, but just Google him because he's been in a lot of stuff. Anyway, so Corbin Burnson is a person running for election or re-election or something like that. And he lives in this mansion and his family has owned this mansion forever. And there are a lot of rumors around this. It's not even rumors. It's a lot of the black people around them, around that live in the area know the history of the plantation. And basically, while Corbin Burnson is given this he's holding this press conference and he's talking about all the things he's going to do as an elected official or continue to do or whatever. This black guy who, you know, basically he's like in coveralls or some like working man's farm man's outfit with a hat and stuff. You've seen him in a lot of stuff. I can't remember his name either. I am a terrible person, but you've seen him, you know him if you saw him, especially if you've seen School Days. He was the black naysayer to the dean of the college. He was like, we need to, you know, whereas Lawrence Fishburne was saying we need to divest from using, from getting money from any of these organizations who are supporting apartheid in South Africa. This black guy was like, we need all of these white people's money. We need all every dollar we can get because black people aren't supporting HBCUs like, you know, other folks support folks support their cultural specific institutions. That guy, the black naysayer guy from School Days. Anyway, I hope you can follow. But anyway, just listen. Anyway, but this black guy is like, you know, you talking all this good stuff, but what you need to do is pay attention to all these spirits. You need to do right by all the people who died at this house, who hung from these trees, talking about all the slaves that died on the front lawn of this house. Because as the story goes, this plantation was notorious for when at emancipation, instead of freeing their slaves, they killed a lot of them and they hung them from the trees and, you know, just outright slaughtered them, some of them. And they're buried all over the land and they need justice. They need to get justice. And so the guy was like, you know, nothing good is going to come to you as long as you're in this house and you're not bringing justice to these people who need justice, who you're not shedding light on what happened to them and you're not giving them the respect that they deserve. Right. And also what happened was there was a rumor that just sounded like a rumor that there was this black woman. Maybe she wasn't a woman at the time, but that for every black person, and it was like wrapped in a little bit of spirituality, right? So for every black person who lost their life violently at that plantation, she made a little doll for them. And somehow or another, their soul was wrapped in that doll. And as a representation, that was just her way of trying to save them, to try to keep a little piece of them, to escape them from, do you know what I mean? Like, If I have to watch it again, and certainly you can glean better from what I'm telling you, but the purpose, basically there was a significance to her creating these dolls. Essentially, like their souls were put into these dolls, and because their souls were in these dolls, that somehow or another these people were still alive, right? All these people whose lives were lost were still alive, and until Corbin Burnson in the role that he was playing did right by his family and right by the people who lost their lives violently at the hands of his family, right? Because he represents kind of that old way of thinking and even that way of what a lot of white folks think now. Yeah, that might have been my ancestors, but that's not me. But you need to understand that there's still some atonement that needs to be made. There's still some rights that need to be, there's still some wrongs that need to be righted. Even though it wasn't you who was, who owned a person or people. Anyway,
So, you know, the Corbin laughs it off, or the person that he's playing laughs it off, and he's just like, man, whatever. I got nothing to do with that. I'm just trying to run a campaign, right? And so the black guy that's with him is like, okay, well, you have to figure out a way to get ahead of this and use it in the right way, spin this in the right way. And long story short, you know, as the black guy, who's a really awesome actor, but anyway, as he's trying to coach him into saying the right things to get ahead of this story or try to get more in front of the story and try to win this campaign, Corbin notices, he starts to notice a doll that the black guy in the beginning was talking about. And at first he like laughs, like, what is this little funky old doll? What is this? Right? And then what we know is that the doll begins to animate. Now, while Corbin doesn't see the doll animate, we see the doll animate, right? And throughout this vignette, and there's a culmination where this doll is starting to cause mischief, right? And there's a reason for it. And so, yeah, it climaxes where basically Corbin essentially pays for, one way or another, he pays for the crimes of his family, right? And I wouldn't say there's that I would not say that in this context that all of the people who lost their lives violently at on that plantation, I wouldn't say that they got justice, but I would say that there was some justice that was done. And I'll just leave it to you to see it yourself. But what I will say is that, again, I stand behind the fact that I believe that this is one of the best vignettes in the whole movie. And so at the end, at the conclusion of it, obviously, because again, in the context, it's like, you know, we're thinking about slavery in a different way now. We're thinking about the remnants of slavery and how long they've been around in these early 90s. And I'm talking about we as in black Americans, especially in the 90s, collectively, we're thinking about slavery and the remnants of slavery at that point in new and different ways. You know, that it didn't end in 1865, and then that only opened up another form of slavery and another form of repression. And then when the Jim Crow South and Jim Crow laws were abolished, it just opened up another form of brutality and flux, you know, flooded with drugs and flooded, you know, and policed by departments that were largely didn't look like them and were overused excessive force and all of that stuff. And then, you know, drugs and all of that stuff. Right. So in this context, even though these drug dealers are very much, you know, doing what they do and contributing to crime and just blight in their community, duh, we're still all black. And so at the end of that story that the funeral director tells, of course, they're like, yeah, he got what he deserved, you know. And yeah, so there's that point where, you know, there's some camaraderie there, right? But the funeral director is like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm still taking you to the stuff. And at this point, you know, both of the thugs are getting, Joe Torre and the other guy who played Junior on Player Club. Anyway, they're getting antsy. Like they're saying, enough of these funky stories. Take me to this stuff now. You take it long. Let's get to the stuff. Let's get to this. I can't even remember the what they called it. They never said drugs though, but again, it was implied that it was drugs that the funeral director was taking them to. So anyway, so he's like, all right. And then they walk through and they see one more thing. Yeah, I think the guy actually gets violent and hits him on the back of the head or whatever. And then they're walking. They're down in the basement. All the while they've been walking through the house, and now they go down to the basement. And so they're walking down this long corridor. And what starts to get funny is that Clarence, he's becoming more erratic, and he's making these noises, and it's like, ooh, and woo, and stuff like that. And it's just weird. Like, he made that weird noise after he got bopped in the back of the head by one of the thugs, who was like, you need to come on here. Cause now, mind you, they have him at gunpoint. Let's go. You playing with me. take me to the stuff. So he hits him on the head. He's like, woo, woo. Like, and he, and Clarence, this is why I think he's so scary. He's a good actor, is that you think this guy is going through something. Like, he is about to transform into something. Something weird is about to happen. You woke up something weird. Just get your thing and get out of there. Get whatever you came for and hurry up and get out of there. And you can kind of tell that the thugs are a little bit nervous too, right? But they're hiding behind the guns, but you can tell they're a little nervous. Anyway, so they're walking down the corridor, and Clarence William III is still being, he's acting more weird and more erratic now. But in the meantime, he's touching these light bulbs to turn them on. And if you can imagine, like every 5 feet or so, there's a light bulb. So he touches the bottom of it, not pulls a lever, not hits a switch, literally touches the bottom of the light and it illuminates. Okay. Red flag, right? So he keeps touching it. Like every 5 feet, there's another light bulb and he's touching it and it illuminates. And you're like, okay, what the heck is this? So anyway, so they get down and what you know is that they're in a basement and they walk to the basement. And the last story is triggered by the fact that they're standing in front of this man that's in a casket. And this man that's in a casket is a, what they call at the time, the terminology that they keep using throughout the film is gangbanger. And nobody uses that term anymore because it's just a dumb term. But yeah, so it's like a gangbanger who lost his life. And then, you know, the thugs get a little quiet. And so he launches into the story. And he's like, yeah, this guy was a gangbanger just like y'all. And he goes into the story. And long story short, this guy, Crazy K, driving around in his, souped up 6-4, I think it is. You know, one of those old school cars that have been souped up and look real, real nice and has a drop top. And so anyway, he's riding around and he's being him. He's got the music loud. It's nighttime. And anyway, he spots a car or whatever of people that, somebody that owes him money. So he circles around and he shoots him. Right. And so in shooting him, you know, somehow or another, he gets caught up. And some people, he gets into basically people, friends of the person that he shot, come after him. And then they corner him and they shoot him up. And he's near death. And then he's taken to the hospital and he is locked up, chained to the bed, but he's got gunshot wounds and they're trying to heal him and all that stuff. And he's fighting and all of that stuff. And then somehow or another, it leads to him being thrown in this room. And again, this is more where respectability comes in. And there's this whole piece. This is my least favorite vignette, by the way. There's this whole piece where there's a doctor coming in there and is yelling at him, basically. Now, mind you, he's thrown in these different rooms and he's the whole time he's in his drawers, basically. So it makes it seem like he's been in this little place, this building for months, or this ward for months, where they're throwing him back and forth to different cells for the purpose of trying to rehabilitate him from being a gangbanger and selling drugs and taking the lives of his community members, right? And so they're yelling at him and they're preaching to him about, you know, you need to do better, you need to be better, and stop taking black lives, black man, and all of that stuff, right? And it gets really weird. There's at one point where they put him in a cell next to someone who is a neo-Nazi, and he's like, you know, I can't stand black people. He does not use that term. I can't stand black people, but you'll sure be in my army because you're the only one apart from me that's taken as many lives, as many black people's out. So you'll, when the riot comes, you'll be, you know, near us. You'll be with us. And I was just that, looking back on it, it is so preposterous. So preposterous. But anyway, that's what it's just a reflection of the time. It's a reflection of the time of what we were saying. That we were blaming all violence in the black community on black people and no outside forces whatsoever. No economic circumstances, no nothing. We were just, you know, young people mad and killing people for no reason. Again, I'm not taking the onus from people who are actually taking lives. But what I am saying is that there's a reason why this circumstance came to be. And it's not because black people are lazy and can't keep a job. Anyway, so anyway, it goes through all of this stuff. And
in the end, there's a choice. Special K has a choice. Oh, by the way, the name of that story is Hardcore Convert. And yeah, so at the end of his time there, he's like had enough of the torture. And they're certainly torturing him and trying to get him to change his ways and stop being a gangbanger and taking the lives of his community. And so there's a point where he's like had enough and he's like, I'm done with this. I don't care no more. I don't care. I don't give a F. I'll give a F. I distinctly remember that. So he like he wakes up and he's in another place. And long story short, the film ends, and I will not tell you how it ends, except to say that the story of Special K and Hardcore Convert directly relates to the gangbangers that came in wanting the stuff. And the stuff is not what you think it is. Like, the stuff is not what the gangbangers thought it was. And Clarence William III, as the funeral director, ends up not being who you think he's supposed to be or that he was playing. You understand that he was playing a game at this point. And it ends creepily in a scary way. There's a lot to criticize in this film, but there's a whole lot to still love about this film. I think it's scary. I think it's kind of creepy. I think it's a film worth watching. And yeah, so yeah, try to watch it if you can. So yeah, I just wanted to talk about that movie because with all of its flaws, I still really, really love it. And I'm in a spooky kind of mood because for the first time in years, a decade or better, I'm actually going to a costume party ahead of Halloween, and I'm a part of a concept. Now, I'm not going to do anything scary because I don't do that. But yeah, I'm going to be a part of a concept. I'm going with two other friends and we're going to be a concept. So we kind of need to be together anyway. not that we have to be together, but we definitely have to be cohesive. So we're working on that now. So anyway, so, you know, this time last year I had begun my, Black American Folklore, Scary Stories My Daddy Told Me, in reference to something that Michael B. Jordan, that fine old man, Michael B. Jordan, had said that black folk really don't have folklore, which is not true. Black Americans don't have folklore. That's just not true. It's kind of like, anyway, it's just not true. And so if you're interested, you can go back and listen to season one, episodes 26, 27, and 28, I think, which are entitled Black American Folklore, Scary Stories My Daddy Told Me. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. There's one point where I talk about hoodoo and voodoo. I actually read some old folk tales, some black stories that were passed around from back in the day. So you might find it interesting. So yeah, anyway, speaking of just shows, you know the routine if you've listened to any episodes before now. Definitely, you know, help spread the news about this podcast in a couple of different ways. So you can donate. That would be great. Even 99 cents will be a helpful contribution. You can go right to the show link on this episode, and it'll take you right to my anchor.fm page, which has a little button where you can leave me a message, which is a way that you can communicate with me, and there's a button to donate. Even 99 cents will be a helpful contribution. But again, as I always say, if donating isn't your thing, but you still want to help, share this episode or any of the other episodes that I've done that you think a loved one, a friend, anybody, an enemy, anybody that you would think would be good, who would enjoy the episode. You know, rate and review positively, of course, on all the places. So player.fm, anchor.fm, of course, CastBox, Pocket Cast, Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcast, Radio Public, anywhere where you listen to this show,
definitely rate it positively, 4 stars, 5 stars, whatever. Because that's going to help spread the news about this show. And it's just basically help reach more people. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you watch the film, because it's really, it is good despite its flaws. All right. So yeah. And leave me a message if after you watch it for the, let's say you watch it for the first time, leave me a message and tell me what you think about it. Okay. I would love to hear from you. All right. That's it for now. Until next time.